I did submit a written statement, but I'm going to deviate completely from that. I've sat through the hearing so far today, and I think there are some important concepts I'd like to convey to the committee in hopes of getting more information to people. I've worked on the PFOA issue for more than 16 years now, and I am a lawyer, but I'm not here in connection with any case in Hoosick Falls. I'm not involved in any of the litigation in Hoosick Falls. As you indicated, you know, in the story in the New York Times, for example, it talks about the litigation I have been involved in against DuPont in West Virginia and Ohio. And that's gone on for many years. And that litigation, though, has really educated me on a lot of the history of PFOA. And I think a lot of that history would be important for the committee to be more familiar with. Listening to some of the presentations today, I think it's critically important that some of this information be known and be available to everybody in the community. Listening to Dr. Martinez at the beginning, for example, you know, a local doctor wanting to know where can I get the information I need to talk to my patients about. And that information is out there, is available. And, you know, I view this this situation involving PFOA in drinking water is a public health threat. That's why I'm here. I view it as a health threat, and I think people are entitled to have as much information as they can to deal with that. And the more information, the more you're able to make your own choices about what you do or what you don't do. At the government level as well, the more information, the better. And that's what I've been trying to do for many years, is to get information available to as many people as possible at as many different levels, at the regulatory level, at the political level, at the scientific level, in the legal arena as well, and in local communities that have been impacted by this chemical. So again, I really appreciate the opportunity to come here today, and I'd like to just address a little bit of this history of PFOA that I think is important. I think one of the speakers indicated before, you know, I first sent a letter to US EPA in March of 2001 after being in litigation with DuPont and looking at documents that indicated this is a toxic chemical, it is a carcinogen, and this has been known for many, many years by some of the manufacturers that have been handling these chemicals. And not only that, it was being released, actively released into the air, into drinking water, in community outside of Parkersburg, West Virginia, for decades. And you know, we've all been hearing about the unregulated status of this material. Well, because of that, it was being actively emitted into the air, into the water, and even though it was in the drinking water and the company knew it was in the drinking water, community hadn't been told. So looking at that information, we believe that was a public health threat and notified the US EPA in March of 2001. This is a toxic chemical. It appears to be a carcinogen. It appears to be something that is actively released into the air, into the drinking water. It appears to be used in lots of consumer products in many different areas. US EPA, we don't think you necessarily know about this. It appears that some of this information hasn't been given to you. Please initiate an investigation into this chemical. We notified the US EPA, US Attorney's Office, the state of West Virginia. Start the regulatory process on this chemical. This is something that ought to be regulated. People should not be drinking this. Again, this is 2001, right? As a result of that, in 2002, the US EPA did initiate what they called at the time a priority review of the chemical under the Toxic Substances Control Act, under TSCA. And after looking at the material we had provided and some of the information they had not seen before, the US EPA in 2003 initiated a very public process under the TSCA statute to try to develop what they were going to call at the time enforceable consent agreements to try to get more information about the chemical. What EPA eventually came out to believe was we had not been given all the information. In fact, this information should have been given to us many, many decades ago. It was withheld. And in fact, they ended up suing DuPont in 2004, saying this is information that should have been provided to us as a federal agency. If it had been given to us earlier, We could have begun the regulation of this chemical decades earlier. So part of this process EPA started in 2003, they identified what they call data needs. And at that point, EPA had looked at some of the blood data, and by then it was already known this chemical was in human blood supplies all over the country, if not all over the world. There is no background level. It is a non-naturally occurring chemical. It is man-made. There was none of this in anybody's blood prior to the 1950s when it started being manufactured. But there is a little bit in everybody's blood. And that concerned EPA after looking at this toxicity information, realizing, ooh, it's in everyone's blood. Look at how widespread the use of this is. We want more information. And again, this is March and April of 2003. And they set up a process at the time to collect that information. And one of the things they say they need is they want the manufacturers and those that are using this chemical, you know, the customers that buy this Teflon or the dispersion product, you know, they're all over the country. We want to know, where has this stuff been used? Where has it been released? Where has it been disposed? How is this getting into human blood? There was a group formed in 2003 called the Monitoring Subgroup, part of this ECA process. The whole purpose was to come up with a voluntary agreement so the companies would provide this information to the agencies. Back then, 2003, where all has this been used? Where are all these different manufacturing or production sites where the chemicals used and maybe released into the environment? And one of the things I remember vividly asking for at the time was water sampling around those communities and blood sampling. Now, this negotiation process, because keep in mind, as people have said, it was not, quote, regulated. So EPA is trying to get voluntary commitments to provide this information. This went on for 3 years. In 2006, that whole process stopped. That ECA process was shut down because EPA worked out an arrangement with manufacturers to phase out making the chemical in the future. This was announced in early 2006, this thing called the Voluntary Phase-Out Stewardship Program. I may be misstating the exact language. But it was announced in 2006 that EPA has this agreement of voluntary commitment by the companies to stop manufacturing PFOA, and it would be phased in over the next 10 years. The companies would be given until 2015 to stop manufacturing. At the time, I remember raising the concern, that's great that they're not going to make this anymore. The problem is, this chemical is a biopersistent material. When it is released into the environment, it stays in the environment for millions of years. It does not break down. It will be in the environment after we're all gone. And most concerning, not only does it stay in the environment, humans exposed to even the most minute amount, the tiniest amount in your water, it builds up in the body over time. It's called biopersistent. Each time you drink, that exposure will build up and up and up and up over time. So the fact that you're going to stop making this stuff is great, but what do you do about the fact that it's likely in dump sites, water supplies all over the country? We raised this fact in 2005, and as we all know, nothing really happened. This announcement was made that we're going to phase this out over, you know, we're going to have a 10-year phase out, and that EPA kind of stopped its process at that point. Over the next several years, I continued to ask EPA, you need to do further investigation of the other places this stuff has been disposed. Over the next several years, it did pop up in other locations, Minnesota, New Jersey, Alabama. And instead of being able to work with the regulatory agencies to actually do something at that point, we were forced to have to deal with this through private litigation. And I don't want to get into the details of all the litigation, but as you know, one of the lawsuits that we had brought was for the people in West Virginia and Ohio. We had about 70,000 people who had been exposed to this in their drinking water out there, who had been drinking it likely for decades in the water. We ended up getting a settlement with DuPont, in 2005. Under that settlement agreement, DuPont agreed that it would pay to put in the granular activated carbon filtration systems. And just so you know, a lot of the research that was done to figure out how do you get this stuff out of the water was done as part of that settlement and a lot of that research back in 2005 and 2006. Those granular activated carbon systems were put in place in six different public water supplies serving tens of thousands of people a decade ago. That data showing that you could reduce PFOA down to non-detect has been out there, publicly available on websites for over a decade. Because those water systems have been supplying that data showing we're able to remove this, we're able to remove it down to non-detect. We also implemented in-home filtration systems under that settlement that DuPont helped design. And again, the technology for doing that and being able to have effective in-home systems, it's a decade ago that was done. So that was the first step of that settlement. One of the other things we did, though, under the settlement was we commissioned an independent science panel that was given a very specific task to look at what will this chemical do to the people who are actually drinking it in their water over a fixed amount of time, all right? And what we'd said is we've got a group of people that we know have been drinking it for years. We want this independent panel to look at what does this chemical do to these folks and tell us whether there's a health effects or there aren't health effects. And we ended up getting an agreement with DuPont that DuPont would fund that study. They would fund setting up this panel. Both sides had the ability to pick three completely independent, world-class epidemiologists. Either side could veto for any reason. So they had to be people that both sides were convinced were unbiased, most world-renowned epidemiologists in the field. We picked that panel, amazingly enough. We were able to get agreement. We picked these three panelists. And those panelists were told to look at all of the data that's out there, not just published peer-reviewed articles, most of which had been by the industry at that point, but also the internal documents that had not been published. But also, very critically, that panel was given the ability to do their own study of the community. And under our settlement, we ended up getting $70 million from DuPont. And we chose to use that money. We didn't just divvy up checks to everybody in town. Instead, we used that money to pay the people to come in and have their blood drawn for PFOA blood tests and to provide medical information. We ended up getting 69,000 people to come in, have their blood drawn, turn over medical information, all kept confidential, of course. But all that data was then given to the science panel. That panel was allowed to design whatever studies they thought they needed. And they had an unlimited budget. Under the settlement, DuPont had to pay whatever that panel decided they wanted to do for a study. They designed the most world-class studies that have ever been done on a pollutant. They designed 12 different studies. They ended up getting data from 69,000 people. They spent 7 years studying this community. And the community, it's critically important to keep in mind, this community, the people they studied, people that were allowed to come in and have their blood drawn, were defined as anybody that had been drinking water with more than 0.05 parts per billion PFOA for more than a year, right? So we're talking about people that had 0.05 parts per billion in their water for at least a year. Some of the communities had more than that. Some were right at 0.05. But this study was looking at those people with that exposure. After 7 years of study, doing whatever study they felt was necessary, they ended up releasing in 2012 their independent findings. Now, there's been a lot of misinformation about what the science panel findings are. Some have referred, I've seen some references, and one of the reasons, you know, like I said, I'm not involved in litigation in Hoosick Falls, but I do monitor information about PFOA and other communities. I saw the information about Hoosick Falls. I saw the media coverage in late 2015, and I saw the references that the community was being told, there's no risk from drinking this in your water, okay? And I did send a letter to the New York State Department of Health and to the village at the time to make them aware that that's simply not accurate based on the data that had been done by the science panel. So I did get involved in that point. But what this science panel did was they looked at all of the data, and they didn't just do one study and find an association between cancer and this effect. They looked at all of the studies, including some studies they did themselves. They looked at all of them, some that found associations with the effect, some that didn't. But they looked at them all and made an overall assessment. Is there a link between drinking this in the water and this disease or not? And in 2012, they said that there was such a link with six different diseases: kidney cancer, testicular cancer, ulcerative colitis, thyroid disease, preeclampsia, and high cholesterol. And importantly, they found that there were no links with dozens of other diseases. Now, that information was all then, those studies, by the way, the studies the science panel did, were later published and peer-reviewed. But all of their results were publicly posted, put online in 2012. They've all been there since then. All of those study results are there, and they've been there since 2012. As I mentioned, I had been advocating to EPA for many years that it needed to do something to regulate this chemical in the water and to take steps to notify people if they were potentially exposed to it and to set appropriate drinking water levels. Keep in mind, by 2012, there was no EPA guideline for long-term exposure in the water. You've heard today, well, there was a guideline since 2009. That was not applicable. All right? In 2009, the US EPA came out with a short-term exposure guideline, which they specifically define on their website. Those definitions are there for all to see. It's specifically defined as being an exposure that's only for a couple of days or possibly a couple of weeks. They had not come out with a long-term exposure guideline yet. States had moved on their own. I mentioned, for example, that this had come up in outside the plant, a 3M plant in Minnesota in 2005, 2006. State of Minnesota went on their own and issued guidelines. And by the way, they declared PFOA a hazardous substance under their state law a decade ago, 2007, 2008 timeframe. The state of New Jersey, when this chemical popped up in the drinking water in New Jersey, 2006, they came out with a long-term exposure guideline, 0.04 parts per billion. That's been out there and have been available since 2007. The US EPA, when these numbers came out, we were kept encouraging US EPA to come out with a long-term exposure guideline. It did not come out with a long-term guideline until May of this year. The 0.07 is the first long-term exposure guideline from US EPA. It's not as if they changed or were inconsistent with the one from 2009. That was the short-term guideline. So there was no long-term guideline other than in some of these states. So when this science panel data came out in 2012, you had some of the most extensive research that had been done on a chemical with direct community exposure of 70,000 people, the most comprehensive, extensive human health studies ever done, reviewed by completely independent scientists who had concluded there are these links. Based on when that information came out, we again encouraged EPA. The science is unequivocal now. Okay, what other chemical do you have this kind of information about, with direct studies done on the people exposed, and encouraged long-term exposure guidelines? And in 2013 is when US EPA, or after these probable links came out, for the first time put PFOA on. You've heard people talk about the UCMR, the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring List. That's when PFOA got put on the list in 2013. And then the data from larger public water supplies, because they're the only ones who are required to actually test under that law, they started supplying data 2013, 2014. We could see that data on the EPA website. And you can see that this chemical is in public water supplies across the country. But these communities are not being told, all right, because it's not required. So we again advocated that these communities needed to be told, this information needed to be put out there. You've got the science panel data. It's done. The data is done. The information's out there. People ought to know about this. That's when I see the information starting to come out from the phenomenal work that Mr. Hickey and the local community here did, where they had to go out on their own and sample the water. All right? Keep in mind, back in 2003, when this EPA monitoring process was starting, EPA was asking for those lists of where all this stuff was sent. What were the customers that were using this material? Where are the different production areas across the country where it was used? Well, here we are in one of those communities, and the way it's found out is the individual going out on their own and sampling their own water supply and finding it out. And then you get this resistance, well, I shouldn't say, I don't want to say resistance, but the information that's being supplied back at that time is suggesting we don't know yet enough about the health effects. It seems fine, go ahead and keep drinking the water. So I sent a letter, that's where I get to the point where I sent my letter to the village and to the state of New York at the end of 2015 to make it clear this data does exist. It is out there. The science panel's already looked at this. You know, we've heard today about the state of New York planning an additional cancer study. That's great. But the link with cancer has already been established. That's been done with 70,000 people over a study that took 7 years. By the way, those science panel studies cost over $30 million. That's been done. So to suggest that there's more data that's needed before you can know whether there's a link with cancer, I don't agree with. And so that's why I'm here today. I want to make sure that people know that information's there. And one of the other things that happened, by the way, once those links were found, all right, again, those reports are all posted. They're available for the public to review. We also then, under our settlement agreement, that triggered the need to develop a medical monitoring panel. We sat down with DuPont and picked three, again, world-renowned, completely independent medical doctors. And their charge under our settlement was, look at these diseases that have been linked. As medical doctors, we want you to look at those and tell us, would it be appropriate to test people for the onset of these diseases? And if so, who in the community ought to get tested, and what would the test be? That panel was set up in 2012. In 2013, they released their report. Again, completely independent panel report. That panel recommended that everyone in the community who had been exposed above 0.05 parts per billion for a year be entitled to monitoring for these diseases. They laid out what the monitoring would be. That report has been posted and available online since 2014. When our medical monitoring program commenced, and it lays out what would the appropriate medical tests be for these people who've been exposed to these diseases. So one of the things I tried to do when I sent my letter to the state and to the village was encourage them to post links to that publicly available information. What kind of testing? That's, you know, an independent panel's looked at that and given their opinion. And doctors in the community ought to at least be able to know that's there and access it and use it for however they will. But the information should be made available. So, I thank you. I apologize for going on here, but I wanted to make sure that people have access to as much information they have and to understand how much of this has already been done and how much of this information is available. It is known. It is there. And it's available for people, and they should have access to it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't know if I have any questions, but the study they're talking about is not a study to get new data. There is a cancer registry, which was, the current one was established in 95. because New York had had a cancer registry that was not in conformity with nationwide standards. So the idea was to redo it so you could be comparing New York data to other states. So they have the data, but what they need to do is take someone to look at that data and say, what does it mean? Look for hotspots and to see where that occurs. And I'm just dismayed that they haven't done that already.
Correct. And one thing to keep in mind is it's very important that, you know, the science panel studies were looking at people who were who they knew had actually been drinking the water and had actually been drinking it above a certain level and for a certain amount of time. So it's important. I don't know how New York State's cancer registry is set up, but I know that in some states, the registries are organized by county or by, you know, in town. Or, in other words, it would be a broader geographical region than the area that's actually got the contamination. And so you want to make sure that you're not diluting an effect by including too many people that weren't actually exposed. And I'm sure that would be something that the state, I'm sure, would be taking into consideration when putting the study together.
Hopefully. Excellent point.
Yeah.
Given your recognition of the permanence of PFOA, do you think that even the standard of 70 parts per trillion is an appropriate one?
No. I do believe it is a very long overdue and positive step in the right direction. But keep in mind, the science panel studies found these links among people who were defined as being using water that had 0.05 parts per billion or more. Okay? The EPA standard is 0.07. All right? And again, it's difficult. You know, that program, setting up and how you come up with those numbers, it's not necessarily clear that applies all that well with a chemical like this that is a biopersistent chemical. That it's not like you drink the water, and as long as it's below a certain amount, you know you didn't get enough of the dose, and it flushes out of you the next day. This chemical, even at the tiniest amount, will build up slowly over time. So there are those in the scientific community that have suggested, you know, that there really is no way to say that X level is safe when you're dealing with something that no matter how little of it you have, you could build up to very toxic high levels at some point. So I think to suggest that 0.07 is some cutoff where you're perfectly fine if you're below that, I don't think is necessarily accurate given the nature of this chemical and its biopersistence.
Thank you. Senator Little?
Thank you for all the information. If I'm on or not. I just had one question. It's taken out of Teflon now, right? So the Teflon products don't use PFOA in their manufacture?
Well, as I mentioned, there was this program, the Voluntary Phase-Out Program, that started in 2006. And since that time, there have been a number of efforts by a number of the companies to reformulate the material.
Okay.
Some of them involve shifting to things that, you know, we heard it referenced today by some of the other speakers, C6s. You know, PFOA and PFOS are a C8. They have 8 carbons attached. And there has been a move by some to replace it and to reformulate it with something that has less carbons, with the idea being that maybe that's less persistent that way. There are a lot of folks in the scientific community that say there isn't much studying done yet on what the toxicity and long-term effects of those replacement chemicals are.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the next step is, you know, who's looking at the replacement chemistry.
And isn't it, I read also in stain-resistant fabrics or water-repellent jackets and things like that, is that still true?
Again, I think it depends on how old the article is, you know, and I think a lot of it has been reformulated over the last several years. Many of the main product lines have switched to different chemistries. Now, how different they end up being in the long run, I think that's an open subject at this point. But a lot of it has been changed in the last 10 years.
Well, thank you for your information. Gives us
Thank you.
Pause to think. Thank you.
I just got a couple of questions with regards to the accumulation of the PFOA in the blood in particular. And the studies that you've been involved with and have reviewed, have they shown a correlation between blood levels and the likelihood of developing cancer down the road?
Well, you know, again, the way the science panel studies were set up, you know, cancer was one of the things they were looking at. And they did look at the community, and it was really focusing more on what have they been exposed to. They're looking at the water exposure levels. And those papers do go in and look at what blood levels were in different groups within that study. But they ended up making an overall conclusion that people in that group, that 70,000-person group, they met the definition of being exposed for more than a year, above 0.05. And again, they're focusing on the external exposure. There was a link with increased cancer in those groups, testicular cancer and kidney cancer.
Has there been any follow-up studies showing how long it takes for those blood levels to decline after not being exposed to the PFOA in the environment?
There have. And in fact, if you go to the C8 Science Panel's website, and that's www.c8sciencepanel.org, they have a list of and links to their publications, and one of the publications focuses on rate of decline in serum levels over time, because they had the opportunity to look at communities where, as I mentioned, these communities put water filtration plants on in 2007 timeframe, and so they went back and asked those people to come in and give blood samples several years later to see how much of the blood level had gone down. So there is literature out there that looks at that, and that is available, and it exists now, to tell you what the levels of decline will be, how many years it's likely to take. That literature's out there. The science panel did a lot of that.
Are you aware if there's anything that can be done to accelerate the lowering of those levels?
Besides removing it from the water and exposure?
No, I mean, besides, whether diet, I mean, for the individual of any way that would, I mean, there's certain things that you can, you change your diet in certain ways and it has an impact on what's in your blood.
You know, I'm not aware of scientific literature out there, at least I'm not remembering it at this point, that has looked at if there's some sort of way we can speed that up or help accelerate the elimination of it. I don't recall seeing that.
Thank you.
Senator Hoylman.
Thank you, and really appreciate you being here, sir. I think we're all sitting here transfixed listening to you. You know, the fact that you mentioned virtually every person alive after the 1950s has trace amounts of PFOA in their bloodstream speaks to the widespread nature of this issue, to say the least. I had a couple of questions. First, the fact that you sent the letters to the village and to the state about the links to the data and the C8 medical panel study. Were those put on the websites? Did you find out?
You know, I jumped on the state. It was the Department of Health's website a day or so ago, and they now have a very extensive list of links. And the C8 Science Panel website is on there.
Fantastic.
But I did not, and I may have missed it, but I did not see any link yet to the medical panel and the medical testing protocols and suggestions that the medical panel had made. I hadn't seen that. I may have missed it, but I did not see it.
The phase out of PFOA, the agreement, I guess, back in 2006 that DuPont and other manufacturers, presumably Saint Gobain was part of that phase out agreement?
I don't believe Saint Gobain was one of the ones that signed it. I don't think they were at the time one that was actually making PFOA. Yeah, that was an agreement that was signed by the companies that were actually making
the
PFOA. Now, there are companies that would then use products made with PFOA, and I don't think they were part of that agreement. So this phase-out agreement was with the companies that were making the actual PFOA itself.
I see. So the fact that Saint Gobain has stopped the use of PFOA has nothing to do with that determination in 2006?
You know, I don't know enough about the specific facts with Saint-Gobain mm-hmm. in particular. I just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Would, in your opinion, Saint-Gobain know or be aware of the C8 medical panel, or that as a user, as a manufacturer that used PFOA, would they have been apprised of the data?
Well, let me just say this. You know, as I think it was Mr. Hickey indicated, you know, he took 5 minutes to jump online, and you could find, you know, he did a search of certain keywords, certain things popped up. I indicated that the C8 science panel, one of the conditions of our settlement is we wanted that data made public. We wanted it available to everyone to be able to use. So the science panel has posted their papers and their link reports online, and they've been there for years. They've been there, you know, since they came out. The medical panel report about testing only came out in 2014, so that's been out since 2014. But you know, if you're asking about what they know about the link reports, all I can say is those are posted online.
Mm-hmm.
Those are available.
In your own personal litigation, I think at least strongly suggested, if not proven, that DuPont had its own studies to show the dangers of PFOA. Correct?
Yeah, I'm a little uncomfortable to talk about
Fair
the
enough.
Pending litigation.
Fair enough.
I think
it's been reported as such,
yeah.
And some refer to PFOA as the tobacco of the chemical industry, where manufacturers and users knew a lot more than they revealed with consumers and citizens and workers and various. Plants across America. Do you think, at this point, just on your based on your observation, do you think Saint-Gobain is living up to its obligation in connection with this water crisis?
You know, again, I'm not involved in any of the litigation
yep.
with Saint-Gobain. I don't represent any of the parties involved in that, and I'd be a little hesitant to say what Saint-Gobain is or isn't doing, because I just don't know. I haven't been, you know, I've been monitoring the situation with the chemical in the water
mm-hmm.
and what's been done as far as the scientific side, the regulatory side, but I have not been involved.
Could you tell me what a company in a similar situation could be doing? More proactively in addressing this issue and working with townspeople and local and state government?
Let me respond this way. I mean, I can tell you what's been done by some companies. In the DuPont situation, unfortunately, that took us years of litigation before we got to the point where they agreed to fund and pay for water filtration systems. Now, also what was critically important was not only did they fund the design, the construction of those systems, but to pay for their operation going forward, because these systems can be expensive. And particularly if you're in a situation where the PFOA may have come from air emissions, If you're a facility that was heating material, or the material was going up into a stack, and we saw the situation in Ohio, where the material was going up into the stack, and you actually ended up with some of the highest concentrations being not the direction the water flowed, or not next to a landfill, but the direction of the air plume from the stacks, because the stuff would fall onto the ground and percolate through and hit the water table. And in those situations, you may actually have increasing levels of PFOA in the water over time, as that material, if it came from the air, goes through the soil and hits the water. So that's why it's important to have provisions in place to make sure that, you know, there's somebody's taking care of the funding of it going forward in time. You know, in Minnesota, after we were involved in some litigation there against 3M, the company agreed to pay for the installation of a water filtration plant there as well. And, you know, through our settlement against DuPont, we used their money to pay for blood testing. It wasn't like the DuPont wasn't paying for the blood testing. We decided to use the money to pay for the blood testing because that was extremely expensive. At the time, there were very few labs that could do it back a decade ago. There's still not that many, but there's more now. But that's a very expensive process going forward, is blood testing and water testing, that the actual cost of going out and testing these water supplies to see if they are going up over time or decreasing.
And in Parkersburg in Ohio, where your efforts were focused, monitoring of residents consists obviously of blood testing. Did anything else that was involved in their biomedical history that is tested or continued to be tested?
As part of our original settlement in 2005, one of the first things we did was just collect the blood data. And that is, you'll hear people refer to that, and I think we heard to some of it today about biomonitoring. Okay, that's simply, oftentimes that's testing to see if there's something in the blood, all right, versus medical diagnostic testing, looking for a particular disease or the onset of a disease. So in 2005 is when we collected the blood data alone, and then just basic background documentation, medical records, that kind of thing.
And that was thousands of people, right?
That was 69,000 people. Under the current program, now that these links have been found under our program, under our settlement from 2005, DuPont's obligated to pay for medical monitoring, the testing to detect the onset of the disease, up to $235 million for that community over time. And that's where we're talking about, specific tests for looking for thyroid hormones, specific things that are laid out in the medical monitoring protocol. It does also include retesting for C8 blood levels, a doctor's visit, right? That's part of the medical program. And we've got thousands of people that have signed up for that program as well. That's the part that's ongoing right now.
So that would seem to be the standard that New York should at least aspire to. In connection with the EPA and their inexplicable, at least it appears to me, unwillingness to have taken these warnings to heart and issue more restrictive guidelines, I think a lot of us are asking, what is the explanation for that?
Don't know. I wish I knew. Don't know. Let me put it this way. There are a lot of alternate theories about that, and I don't want to, I think we could go on for hours about that. But, I mean, there were a lot of competing factors going on, a lot of different forces on the EPA side, on the industry side, on the scientific regulatory side that I think resulted in where we're at now.
If you were us, and that may be hard to imagine, members of the New York State Legislature, who else would you be having testify before Senate and Assembly committees on this issue? Who should be asked these difficult questions?
I think, again, that's your prerogative.
Yes.
But I think you had identified a list of different entities that you had identified early on, some of which are here, some of which are not, but it would seem like that encompassed most of them.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.